Again, what you're about to hear is a segment from One Step Beyond from October 22nd, 1989, exactly 9 months after the first segment that you heard from January 22nd of that year. And in the segment you're about to hear, information will be presented that Patrick Edward Purdy had been in the Moonies, and I suspect that may have been where he was placed on his mind control track, so to speak, if in fact he was the mind control job that I believe he was. So here is One Step Beyond, or a segment of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond from October 22nd, 1989. And welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. One of the items that I've been talking about throughout calendar year 1989, particularly in the earlier part when it was in the news more, concerned what I refer to as Purdy's Last Stand. That is a perhaps cruel nickname that I have attached to the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre from January of 1989, specifically I believe it was January 18th. Basically, a drifter, quote-unquote, a penniless drifter, quote-unquote, and we'll talk more about that in a second, a fellow named Patrick Edward Purdy showed up at the Cleveland Elementary School in Stockton, California, and shot up a whole bunch of school children, almost all of them Asian immigrants, killing, I believe it was five, and wounding a great many more. Among the aspects of this killing that were not looked into were the fact that, or at least not looked into very thoroughly, the fact that Purdy, although supposedly a lone nut, had not only Aryan Nations literature on him at the time of an earlier arrest, but had an Aryan Nations inscription, SSA, which refers to SS action, on his assault rifle at the time of the massacre. He also was spouting a racist line, which is not atypical of much of the type of verbiage that the Aryan Nations elements issue. And apparently, at least according to the official investigation, he had no connections with no known hate groups. It's not explained how he came up with the Aryan Nations literature. And again, from the nature of much of what he had to say, it appears that he was affected considerably by their indoctrination. Whether it was from the literature or whether he had more extensive contacts remains to be seen. But from the way Patrick Purdy traveled around with little apparent financial support, he literally traveled all over the country, and in spite of the fact that he had very little money, he was able to make hundreds of dollars in weapons purchases and generally do a lot of things that he would not appear to have been able to do if the official version of the case was the right one. Well, basically, it became pretty apparent upon studying this case, or at least I am convinced at this point, that Edward Patrick Purdy was another one of these intelligence patsies which have been unleashed by the national security establishment since, really they've been going on for a long time, but the most prominent and the real beginning of this onslaught was the assassination of President Kennedy in the Guns of November and other broadcasts. Specifically, let me give you the numbers for people that are new. The Guns of November, the four-part series dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy. Also, Radio Free America programs 11, 12, 13, and 15 all deal with the assassination of President Kennedy. In addition, there is Kennedy material in a miscellaneous archive broadcast about Lee Harvey Oswald, General Edwin Walker, and German and American neo-Nazis. And there's also even, there are some Kennedy connections to the Iran-Contra scandal. There's an interesting Aryan Nations connection to the Kennedy assassination and the Iran-Contra scandal in the person of Lauren Eugene Hall. That is included in the Drug Tug Lenvest case, which is both listed as an independent archive show. It's also in the archives as an addendum to Radio Free America 35, the last of the Iran-Contra series in the Radio Free America archives. Basically, the one of the things that it is important about studying our assassinations is to not only understand the basic fact that our national security establishment has been employing deadly force in covert operations in the United States, as they have abroad for quite some time, it's also important to understand the methodology. And when you've seen some of these supposed lone nuts like Lee Harvey Oswald and Saran Saran and Arthur Bremer, and when you see them traveled around, it becomes relatively easy to spot the anomalies in the official explanation for Patrick Edward Purdy's behavior. One of the most important pieces of research that was done by Mabe Russell, whose work serves as one of the major foundations for, well, basically the foundation for my work here, Obviously, I've been able to build on that foundation considerably, but still, it would be impossible to exaggerate the degree of influence of May's work on my own. One of the major contributions of May to American political science, and one of the reasons I personally consider her to be by far and away the greatest political researcher in this country, in this century, with the possible exception of George Seldes. But May did some landmark work on what she referred to as the California violences. Basically, May made out an excellent case, and Radio Free America number 23 touches on this, as well as a miscellaneous archive series called The Ultimate Evil, Mind Control, Satanism, and the U.S. National Security Establishment. May's own spade work, her initial groundwork on this particular information, on this particular phenomenon, led her to believe that many of the so-called California violences, such as the Symbionese Liberation Army, the Manson family, and the People's Temple, and other examples of violent California craziness, were in fact a very sophisticated form of terrorism that were being put into effect by the U.S. National Security Establishment under the auspices of the Reagan and gubernatorial administration here in California. Basically, May's scenario has borne out very nicely, and it is my belief that Patrick Edward Purdy was yet another example of one of these mind control zombies, and his shooting, the what I call Purdy's last stand, was yet another of what May referred to as the California violences. Also, very briefly, one of the major elements in May's scenario of the California violences is mind control. Basically, another groundbreaking element, another groundbreaking contribution of May was that she was the first person to begin doing research on the CIA and military's mind control programs. May had basically been asserting for many, many years, long before anyone else would admit it, and not many will even now, that in fact the U.S. National Security Establishment had been using various mind control techniques to do a number of different things, including to get people to commit assassinations against their will and without their awareness. These techniques involve a combination of operant and classical conditioning. They involve psychosurgery, psychopharmacology, the use of mind-altering drugs, and hypnosis. And usually they involve combinations of all of those techniques to produce some really very sophisticated behavior patterns and forms of mind control. There are indications, I think, very firm indications, that Patrick Edward Purdy was not only under mind control, but was another one of these intelligence patsies, another one of these fall guys, basically programmed to perform his act, and that, in fact, his act was a provocation. It is my feeling that the move to limit firearms and to limit assault rifles that followed the outrage over the Cleveland elementary school shooting was preordained. I feel that the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre was a provocation, that it represented an incident deliberately generated by reactionary elements of our national security establishment. And in Radio Free America shows 10 through 13, we examined how this national security establishment utilizes Aryan nations for some of their purposes. We've also touched on that in other broadcasts. But it is my belief that the national security establishment generated this incident through poor Purdy here, that he was a sacrificial lamb, a fall guy, another one of these people who was designed to go down from the start, and that this incident was not only part of a much larger program of school terrorism that I referred to, which I think both parents and children of the so-called baby boomers and their babies will be significantly affected by what I feel is a deliberate program of a terrorism directed in the direction of children and schools in particular. Again, this is a kind of thing that sounds, you know, really way off the beam and crazy to a lot of people. It should be noted that this kind of thing has been seen in the past. One of the things we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show called The Pink Triangle, dealing with the persecution of the gay rights movement in Weimar Germany in comparisons with the gay rights situation in the United States today, we went into the Fritz Haarmann case, which was an apparent terrorist incident, an apparent provocation generated by the National Security Establishment of Weimar Germany, again apparently working through the Hanover Germany Police Department. And in this case, a Hanover police informant and operative named Fritz Haarmann, who was mentally deranged, although he continued to work for the Hanover police, which were headed up by a fellow who founded the Freikorps that I alluded to earlier. Basically, Fritz Haarmann would go out and abduct young boys, sexually molest them, then kill them, butcher their corpses, and market the flesh as horse meat. Again, the circumstances of the case strongly suggest that this was a provocation, and it in turn had an electrifying effect on the German public. It had the effect of driving them to the right and just producing a feeling that something had to be done to stop this kind of aberration. Basically, a very strong, tangible law and order sentiment. And again, people don't think of things like the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre as political events, in spite of the fact that they are profoundly political. The press coverage of these massacres, these lone nuts who show up and, you know, blow away a school, is a very, very significant political event. By the way, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. People don't think of these as political events, and yet the Cleveland Schoolyard Massacre, and again, I'm skipping around a bit because the full discussion of the Cleveland Schoolyard Massacre, the Cleveland Elementary School shooting, would be, again, too broad for the purposes of the discussion here, but it not only represented an excuse to begin limiting the public's access to firearms. This, I feel, is part of a program, a preordained program of political reaction, but it also serves to terrorize the living hell out of people. People are much more willing to see their rights compromised. They're willing to see the Bill of Rights abrogated. They're willing to see greater and greater powers by the national security establishment and the police forces. They will accept a police state in order to preclude the possibility of their children getting shot up at school by these nuts who are running around. Again, it's not thought of as a political event. It is profoundly political, and this is why, in my opinion, and obviously this builds on May's work, some of these lone nuts, and I'm not suggesting all of them by any means are hypno-programmed, but a lot of them appear to be, and there are continuing indications that this may have been the case with Patrick Edward Purdy. Bear in mind also that a teacher from the Cleveland Elementary School who was going to testify at a hearing with regard to the possibility of banning assault rifles received a threatening letter with the swastika letterhead. Whether there's any connection at all between that and the Aryan Nations literature and the Nazi orientation, the Aryan Nations graffiti sported by Patrick Edward Purdy remains to be seen. But again, it was my scenario, and again, we don't know for sure, but it is my hypothesis that Purdy was one of these mind-control zombies and that this event was another one of the California violences. Information pointing in that direction, again, not conclusive, but information pointing in that direction was unearthed by a diligent listener who found this particular information in the Stockton Record of October 7th of 1989. I'm going to read some sections of a Stockton Record article by Paul Feist, F-E-I-S-T, of the Record. It's had the state line Sacramento and headlined, Purdy Report fills in details but still leaves questions. Violent, desolate childhood fueled hatred of Asians. Oh, by the way, bear in mind, too, that the spokesperson for the Stockton School District, in which this event occurred, had been the chief spokesperson for the U.S. Army Western States Command until 1985. Again, that may be totally apocryphal, but I thought in light of the limiting of access to firearms and with some ominous indications of the involvement of the military and civilian law enforcement to combat the drug menace and what I viewed as a creeping martial law scenario, that is an interesting thing to keep in mind. Again, it may be apocryphal, but it may be significant. Again, going back to the Stockton Record of October 7th of 1989, this Paul Feist article has a number of interesting details about Patrick Edward Purdy. Predictably, perhaps, the commission that investigated this incident and specifically was looking for any connections between Patrick Purdy and hate groups found no connection. Again, I wonder where he got the Aryan Nations literature. It appears to have had an effect on his thinking. He had an Aryan Nations graffito on his rifle at the time he performed this crime. In this Paul Feist article, there's an interesting piece of information. Again, this is from a 1981 examination by a psychiatrist of Patrick Purdy, and it relies on information provided by Purdy himself. But here's an interesting detail, and something the press has not covered, something that has not received a lot of publicity. The he here is Purdy. He said he had panhandled for the Unification Church, run by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, but left after he realized he could keep only a small amount of the money he received. Well, in Radio Free America number 7, we specifically looked at the Unification Church as one of the main examples of a number of cults that appear to have been used by the National Security Establishment and the intelligence agencies, and beyond that, which appear to be outgrowths of the CIA and military's mind control programs. So it's interesting here to see that Patrick Purdy had worked for the Unification Church. Again, he was a panhandler. Doesn't say how long he worked for them or how old he was when he worked for them. But this is interesting here because the Unification Church is nothing if not an explicitly political organization, and it is explicitly fascist. Its roots go back to, I guess you could call it Imperial Korea, to Korea when it was a Japanese colony, and when many of the key Korean military people who were to figure in the Unification Church were working for the Imperial Japanese military during World War II. Certainly its roots go back to Imperial and Fascist Japan. So it's interesting to see Edward Patrick Purdy, or Patrick Edward Purdy. I'll probably do that from now till God knows when. That's just one of those things. I think of Edward Patrick Purdy, but it's Patrick Edward Purdy. I'll think of Pep. That's the way to do it. I'll think of him as Pep. Pep's last stand here. Interesting, again, going into that same Paul Feist article to look at some of the descriptions of Patrick Purdy. Skipping down again in that same article, again, Stockton Record, October 7th of 89. In 1986, Purdy went to the Sacramento County Mental Health Center and complained of hearing voices. He cried and said his mother severely abused him as a child. Purdy said he was living in his car and was feeling lonely and unloved, unquote. Quote, I'm not thinking the way I should be thinking, unquote, Purdy was quoted as saying. He said he sympathized with a postal worker who had shot several co-workers in Oklahoma. He said he was hearing voices telling him, quote, to do things, unquote. These are dismissed, these sorts of things are dismissed as elements of schizophrenia, paranoia, hallucinations, and certainly people suffering from those types of psychopathology do hear voices. One of the problems is, though, that the CIA's mind control programs also led to people who experienced similar things as a result of those programs. So the fact that somebody's hearing voices telling him to do things doesn't automatically mean the guy's flipped his lid. It may mean that somebody has flipped it for him. One of the things that I brought out earlier in the year in connection with some of these schoolyard shootings is that many of these people do have some interesting connections. There was a schoolyard bombing in, I believe it was Nebraska or possibly Oklahoma, one of those two states, and or maybe it was Kansas, I've forgotten which, one of those states, and the people involved in that had connections to the Aryan Nations. There was a schoolyard shooting down in Southern California. The guy had connections to the People's Temple, which, as we've looked at, appears to have been an intelligence front. Again, Radio Free America shows 6 and 7. It's interesting here to see that Patrick Edward Purdy not only had come in contact at some point with the Aryan Nations, but that he apparently was working for the Unification Church, explicitly a mind control organization, and an organization which has achieved virtual dominance in the conservative wing of the Republican Party at this point. So again, this is possibly a very significant detail. It may be, if my hypothesis is correct, if it is correct, this may be where Patrick Purdy was gotten onto his mind control track, so to speak. This may have been where, I guess you could say, he left the road. This is where perhaps he was placed on the road to his last stand at the Cleveland Elementary School. It's interesting, too, a couple of other pieces of information here. Again, the conclusion was that Patrick Purdy was a lone nut. Interesting, too, he had some of the inscriptions that he had, some of the graffiti that he had around his room and on his clothing. He had the symbol for the Zodiac Killer as well. May hypothesize that the Zodiac Killer was one of those California violence as a form of provocation. Gave bad publicity to the so-called counterculture, served to terrorize people. They never caught the Zodiac Killer. They did, however, catch a guy named David Toschi, or Toschi, T-O-S-C-H-I, who was the detective in charge with investigating the case, and they caught him writing Zodiac notes. They just said it was a product of professional stress. He'd been on the case too long. But it is interesting that in light of May's hypothesis that this was a provocation, albeit a very sophisticated one. We see the head of the chief detective in charge with catching the Zodiac killer writing Zodiac notes to the police. Again, not conclusive, but awfully interesting and suggestive of May's hypothesis as being a correct one. Interesting that Purdy had Zodiac killer insignia on him at the time, or in his room and on his person at the time he pulled off the Stockton schoolyard killings. Also, again, one of the points that I made about Edward Patrick Purdy at the time was that he appeared to do far too much traveling for someone on his very limited income. He had a disability check for something like 600 some odd a month, yet he traveled all over the country, and he did much more traveling than would appear to have been possible given his income. From another article about Purdy's background, this from the Stockton Record, again, October 7th of 89, by Sam Quinones of the Stockton Record, an article called Rare Study Conducted on Gunman's Motivations. A couple of details skipping down in the article. There were gaps. One of the people here is Stockton police, is someone named Yee. This is one of the California police officials involved with investigating Stockton's background. There were gaps throughout his whole life, Yee said. The agents traveled within Northern California, but relied on other agencies for information on Purdy's frequent nationwide wanderings. The agents estimated they used 42 different law enforcement departments across the country. Again, that is indicative of the way this guy got around. And again, it is not absolutely conclusive, but it's real fishy the way this guy was able to travel around, get busted, go in and out of jail with no apparent means of support. Now, given the fact that jail prisons are crowded, it's not surprising that he could get in and out of jail, but got an awful lot of traveling for someone with his limited means of support. And again, I think the Unification Church connection needs to be explored. I'm not at all satisfied with the explanations for the Aryan Nations literature. Basically, there haven't been any. It's just one of those things that has been allowed to drop. One of the reasons that I talk so much on this program, both about the influence of the Third Reich's intelligence system on the development of our own, and in turn about the profound sympathies on the part of many American industrialists and financiers for fascism, is that we see in this country, since the end of the Second World War, we see many Nazi national security policies being put into effect in this country. We see Third Reich national security methodology taking root in the United States. And one of the major foci of this broadcast, one of the major themes of these broadcasts over the years, and again, something that Mae Russell did groundbreaking research on, concerns the use of provocation, the Reichstag scenario. Set up an incident, use it as a justification for a preordained policy. Again, after when Hitler was appointed chancellor, he staged a provocation in which the German parliament building, the Reichstag, was burned down. This was blamed on the communists. A former member of the Dutch Communist Party named Martinus van der Lubbe, who was both legally blind and legally insane, was blamed for the crime and then basically railroaded into jail. His head was chopped off, and this was used as an excuse by Hitler to declare dictatorial powers. Basically, the commies are upon us. You should declare, give us total power, and we will protect you. The rest is history. Well, this is a type of scenario that we have seen emerging with increasing frequency in the United States in the post-war period. And again, there are profound indications that we are seeing this as a direct result of the importation of the Gehlen Organization at the end of World War II, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, which paved the way for thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans to move into our own intelligence system. One of the reasons why I thought the Patrick Edward Purdy killing, or his act, was so significant was the reflexive, spasmodic way in which all of a sudden, whereas gun control has gotten no place in the United States despite decades of debate on the subject, all of a sudden there are gun control bills popping up all over the place, both at the state and federal level. And in particular, they're focusing on assault rifles, and assault rifles have been one of the mainstays of the paramilitary right for a long time. When in the early 80s, the survivalists and the Soldier of Fortune crowd were parading all over rural America in their camis and with their assault rifles to either get ready for a nuclear war or hunt down the commies or who have you, we didn't see any great outcry about assault rifles. But with increasing limitation of our civil liberties and with the frightening entrance of the military into civilian law enforcement in order to combat the drug menace, an unprecedented constitutional step which is receiving very little debate. I've referred to this as creeping martial law, and I think a damn good case can be made out for this. When we see the military assuming a civilian law enforcement role for the first time, and we see the first substantive gun control legislation being passed as a direct reaction to this spectacular incident in Stockton, when we see the spokesperson for the Stockton School District being the former spokesman for the U.S. Army Western States Command, when we see Patrick Edward Purdy apparently having had connections to the Aryan Nations, he had their literature, he was espousing their views, he was wearing their graffiti, and he worked for the Unification Church. 42 different law enforcement agencies had cases on this guy. He was able to travel all over the country. And again, as the Stockton Record article indicated, he had gaps in his background. That is very significant and possibly conclusive. Well, not conclusive, but it's very significant. When you see these low nuts with these gaps in the background, how many gaps in his background could he have with 42 different law enforcement agencies having records on him? That's a lot more officialdom than most people have keeping tabs on them. Again, not conclusive, but all of those things add up to the types of indications that we have with a Lee Harvey Oswald, Saran, Arthur Bremer type mind control zombie, courteous of the national security establishment. And it's worth looking at, I think worth reviewing in this context, the key involvement of a quote ex-unquote CIA agent, and again that's a very dubious concept, in gun control, and specifically the two leading handgun control organizations in this country, Handgun Control Incorporated and the National Coalition to Ban Handguns, two supposedly competing organizations, were founded by the same newly retired ex-CIA agent at just about the same time, and this in turn was right after the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, in which Richard Nixon had dismissed Archibald Cox, Watergate special prosecutor, and several Justice Department officials who refused to go along with that act. It's worth noting that, again, going back to the landmark research of Mae Brussel, in Radio Free America program number 23, there are we document some work done by Mae Brussel and other members of the Citizens Investigation, or the Citizens Investigating Commission. Basically, the Citizens Research and Investigation Commission, that's what it is, the CRIC, basically a group of journalists and activists who looked into some of the darker sides of some of the darker aspects of the Watergate scandal, and in particular some of the dark doings of the Reagan administration in California, and also of the Nixon presidential, or the Reagan gubernatorial administration's intersection with the Nixon administration in things like the Garden Plot, Operation Cable Splicer, and martial law scenarios that were being developed. Now, in Radio Free America number 23, we went into, among other things, some material from the book called The Glass House Tapes. This was a book put together based on the CRIC's work with Lewis Tackwood, who was an agent for the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department, which in turn functioned as a provocateur group and as a sort of a super police intelligence organization, working in conjunction with the CIA and FBI. And this particular branch of the LAPD, the criminal conspiracy section of the LAPD, literally hatched criminal conspiracies. It was a provocateur group. And one of the things that they were working on was a scenario, and again, this is documented in the Glass House Tapes and in Radio Free America 23, they were working on a contingency scenario to set up a terrorist incident at the Republican convention in 1972 and use this as an excuse for canceling the elections and suspending the Constitution. This was confirmed by, among other institutions, the Rand Corporation. So this is not some crazy fly-by-night radical doctrine or radical fantasy for those people who are not familiar with it and might be inclined to dismiss it in those terms. This was confirmed by the Rand Commission. And again, if you can hunt down the book, The Glass House Tapes, Avon Press, copyright 1973, a rare softcover edition, you can confirm that. Otherwise, RFA 23 will have to do under the circumstances. But again, that's what was going on at the time. This was the scenario that was being developed by the Nixon administration and the National Security Establishment, or actually by the National Security Establishment at this time. And it is at this time that we see Ed Wells, a CIA agent retiring, quote-unquote, from the CIA, And we see him founding the two leading and supposedly competing handgun control organizations. One of the people who's lent him key support over the recent years was former CIA Director William Colby. Now, again, we've had this information before. We've covered it. I'm going to review this. Now, this is from Guns and Ammo magazine from January of 1989. It's a column by Neil Knox in Guns and Ammo. It's called From the Capitol. And in an article called Exploring the CIA Connection, or a section of the column called Exploring the CIA Connection, Neil Knox writes as follows. The Washington intelligentsia tittered nervously when the Washington Post's gossip column reported that William Colby, appointed director of the CIA by President Richard Nixon, was hosting a fundraiser in his home for their beloved National Coalition to Ban Handguns. Quizzed about the curious connection between a pair of the Washington establishment's most hated and most fawned over organizations, Colby said he had been, quote, quietly working with NCBH for the past several years, unquote, and that he had, quote, learned of the dangers of handguns during his years at the CIA, unquote. From September 4th, 73 to January 30th of 1976. I would add that William Colby had worked for the CIA for a long time before that. And then Neil Knox goes on to write, very interesting. NCBH was established in 1974 by the Reverend Jack Corbett of the Board of Church and Society of the United Methodist Church. He was greatly assisted, quote-unquote, Reverend Corbett told me at the time, by Ed Wells, the executive director of the similarly named and ostensibly competing National Coalition to Control Handguns, later renamed Handgun Control Incorporated, which was also established in 74. Actually, I was slightly incorrect. Ed Wells did not found the NCBH, or did not found the NCBH, but was greatly involved or provided great assistance to the Reverend Corbett, who did. He did found Handgun Control Incorporated. Continuing here with Neil Knox's article. Ed Wells was correctly identified in HCI Chairman Nelson Shields' book as having, quote, just retired from the CIA, unquote. Maybe he was retired, and maybe he just disliked guns, though a friend of his once innocently told me Wells owns two handguns and a Sharps Borchard rifle when he set up these groups, or owned two handguns and a Sharps Borchard rifle when he set up those groups. A conspiracy theorist, particularly one who thinks Nixon's CIA was trying to take over the country, might claim HCI and NCBH were established as CIA fronts. But that would be illegal, he then adds with obvious tongue-in-cheek. Well, obviously I'm asking exactly the same question. There's a term that gets used in the intelligence community, and it's called sheep dipping, and it means exactly what the term says. It's the idea of, you've heard of a wolf in sheep's clothing. Well, that's the idea. The idea is to take a wolf and make it appear to be a sheep so that he can wander about in the flock. One wonders if Ed Wells' retirement was simply a sheep-dipping operation. That is as common a scenario as you will ever see with the intelligence community. Somebody retires, quote-unquote, in order to continue to work for the agency in a civilian undercover capacity. Whether or not that was the case with Ed Wells remains to be seen, but bear in mind that there was a strong possibility of martial law having been instituted had Mae Russell and the other members of the Citizens Research and Investigating Commission not done their work on the criminal conspiracy section, and had they not broken Tackwood's information, who knows? But at this very period, we might have had martial law. It's worth bearing in mind Wells' CIA connections, his gun control proclivities, his association with William Colby in this organization. And bear in mind, too, the Patrick Purdy situation and the banning of guns. The first substantive gun control legislation followed that incident. Again, this is the type of thing that is so symptomatic of provocation. My personal opinion, and I think the facts are pointing in that direction very strongly, is that it was a preordained, prearranged incident.
And that concludes the segment of One Step Beyond from October 22nd of 1989. By the way, I apologize for the static on that recording. It was unavoidable. That was the first broadcast after the Loma Prieta earthquake, and our transmitter had sustained some damage, so that was coming right from the transmitter. A couple of notes. It's worth noting that, as we covered in Harry Martin's, in an archive show based on Harry Martin's Zodiac series, as it turned out, May's forecast was correct, or her analysis was correct. The Zodiac killer was not a lone nut. On the contrary, There are substantive indications that there were several Zodiac killers, and there were appear to have been elements of the Manson family involved. Another interesting observation is that the Zodiac sign, which appears to represent the crosshairs of a gun sight, is also remarkably similar to the so-called cross wheel, which the Ku Klux Klan wears on the breast of their robes. That has been identified by law enforcement authorities as representing a fascist sign. Basically, it's a slight corruption of the swastika. I would also note that these school terrorist incidents, ironically enough, add a whole new level of meaning to the phrase or the term baby boom. And I know over the years, folks, when I'm onto something, and I'm onto something here, and although this might seem a little far out to some of you, I would pay attention to it because you never know. The next baby that gets boomed just might be your baby. That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast.